Well, 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 good morning, everybody. Hope you're doing magnificently. Look at me trying out a new camera and everything. How are you guys doing today? Good morning. I hope you're having a wonderful weekend and looking forward to a lovely, juicy chat. I have a hat because my hair is in that electric dandelion daffodil phase. So until I get around to buzzing it, I'm going to wear a hat. So yeah, I hope you guys are doing well. Good morning. Let's jump straight into the questions. What are your thoughts on ChatGPT? Don't know much about it. I know that it's got a lot of users, but I don't have any thoughts about it. Thoughts on the destruction of the Western family. 45% of women are expected to be single and childless by 2030. Well, that's a fine question. So the family is the environment in which cultural and moral values are transmitted. And if you want to change society rapidly, you have to keep mothers away from their children. There's no other way to do it, because otherwise there's a ballast and immovability. I mean, I genuinely think of the tragedy of the children growing up now as opposed to when I was growing up. And of course, you know, I had my issues with my childhood and all that, but the craziness wasn't there in universities. It really wasn't. I mean, I was educated by the Second World War generation of people who believed in objective morality, who believed in universal truth. I mean, there was obviously some relativists and so on in the environment, but it wasn't as insistently crazy as it is now. So yeah, you have to get children are enormously impressionable. You know, children, you say, oh, children are resilient. No, children aren't resilient. Children are adaptable. When we're born, I mean, one of the great and terrible things about us as a species is that when we're born, we have no idea what we're going to be born into, whether it's peace or war, whether it's plenty or famine, whether it's monogamy or polygamy, whether it's hot, whether it's cold, whether there's plenty of food or scarcity of food, whether there's winter, whether there's not. So we are extraordinarily adaptable, which is why if you really want to change society, you have to separate children from their mothers and you have to put them into centralized institutions. You have to put them into a daycare. You have to put them into government schools. You have to separate them. So the goal, of course, of those who want to change society the most rapidly is to convince women that child rearing is beneath them. Right, that they are, you know, glorious goddesses of red carpet potential, and that raising children is being a broodmare, raising children is drudgery, it's being enslaved to the patriarchy, and so on. And that way you are programming the women to hand their children over so that other people can program the children. I wish there was a better way to put it. There really ain't. So that's a central purpose. It's been going on, of course, for a long, long, long time. And you convince women that their highest calling is to be out there in the workforce or to be out there creating things or to enjoy their 20s, to travel, social justice, like anything other than be at home and transmit the cultural values they inherited to their children. I mean, someone's going to educate the kids. And someone's going to mold their minds. And if it ain't the moms, it's going to be other people. So, and so it's devilish, really, in a way. I'm working on all of this stuff in my new novel. So it's devilish in a way, because what does the devil do? The devil says that pleasure is better than sacrifice. That enjoyment is better than difficulty. That, I mean, it's seducing you, right? I mean, I was raised with the high road is the hard road, that it's a slippery slope. The pleasure will feel good in the moment and will cost you your soul, if not your civilization, later. So when women are young, and women are born with value, men have to achieve value. I don't say this with resentment, it's just because of all of what my ancestors and your ancestors chose. This is the nature of the beast. So for women, if you say to women, you can continue to get attention, you can continue to get resources, you can travel, you can have a lot of fun, you can work in an office where there's wine coolers and you can have lunch to tinkly music on TikTok on the roof. You say all that to women, and it's really, really tempting. It's really tempting to take what nature has provided for value and turn it to the pleasure of your own selfish instincts. It's very tempting. Nature has designed women, in a sense, to be so extraordinarily attractive to men, and has designed male hormones to charge after women like bulls off a cliff sometimes. And I mean, everybody remembers this, right? You remember this when you were a kid, that if you were playing a sport, you're playing baseball or whatever it is, and some kid comes along and says, oh, my sister wants to play. And everyone's like, oh, fine, okay. You know, we'll be nice, but it's really going to not... Like, you would view that as a negative. And then, you know, the switch gets flicked on at puberty, and suddenly it's like, girls, 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 girls. And you sort of lose your mind in that way. So that massive escalation of value for females after a certain period of time where boys, you know, ew, cooties, the, you know, He-Man Woman Haters Club and all that sort of stuff. And I never hated girls, but I was never never in particular pursuit of them, of course, until puberty comes along. So then you go from relatively low status to massively high status. And it's a wild, wild process. I have trouble imagining it from the female perspective. It's just a wild process to go through. And taking that massive elevation in status when you go from roll your eyes, last pick on the baseball team, to the central focus of hundreds of boys in government schools, right? Hundreds of boys' attention. I mean, I still remember the girl who was the queen bee in my junior high school when all of this hit. And I remember meeting her at a party many years later, and she still looked back with great fondness at being the it girl in junior high school, right? I mean, like that guy in... The Glass Menagerie, who remembers high school, the high school hero. So to go from low status to enormously high status, the reason that nature does that is so that women are desired by men, and men will work very hard to show evidence of resource acquisition or a potential for that, so that they can get the highest quality woman. And then, of course, they would have sex, she would get pregnant, and that beauty, that desirability would largely be scraped away by arduous labor, by having kids, by being out in the sun, you know, you name it, right? And so it's just supposed to be a brief flash, what they used to call a Lucifer flare. A Lucifer flare is when you've got to light a match on stage, you light the match and it flares up. It's got to be big and dramatic so that the people in the back can see it. So that massive rise in value is really heady. And it's like cocaine, really. It's not sustainable. But if you offer women the chance to sustain that, oh, you can use your beauty and your desirability to get lots of money, to travel, to get lots of dates, to be pursued, to be lusted after, to have thirsty men get you comment on how beautiful you are. And you can go on TikTok and you go on Instagram and all these things, and people can just talk how beautiful you are. But that's really seductive. It's really seductive because it says what nature has designed, funny story, turns out that what nature has designed is not for the continuance of your entire culture and civilization. No, 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 no. It's for your narcissistic pleasure. It's not for a family. It's not for kids. It's not for continuation. It's not for the honoring of your ancestors by passing rational values along to your children. No, it's not for any of that. It is for you to get the fading thrill of attention. Do you want love or do you want attention? And again, I'm working on all this in my new novel. So do you want love or do you want attention? It's a big, big question now. God, nature, Jesus himself says attention is the devil's plaything. Attention will lead you to sterility, will lead you, like you will get joy in the here and now. But when you hit the wall, 30, 35, 40, for the next half a century, you will be miserable. You will be in a state of misery and horror, and then they will give you fistfuls of psychotropics, and you will become a nag and a scold, and you will then try and hard to destroy the pleasure of younger women by hiding your own misery. And so I'm doing the Lord's work out there. Oh, at least I was doing the Lord's work out there on social media, reminding women in particular that stuff that their fathers should have told them, right? although they probably didn't have their fathers or know their fathers. But their fathers should have told them, your beauty and your desirability is not for your own ego gratification. That's like a man inheriting $1 billion and thinking he's just a genius businessman. Nope, just inherited. It was given to you accidentally by nature, and for you to turn what nature has provided for the continuation of your culture into your own narcissistic, selfie, crap vanity is to wrestle the hard-won product of billions of years of life and death evolution and to turn it towards you getting the dopamine thrill of a little bit of attention that fades away, and you, I mean, you're still replaceable. I mean, pretty women are just so replaceable. I mean, there's always new ones coming up and all that, so I guess fewer and fewer now, but so. Yeah, destruction of the Western family, you have to participate. It's not done by force. You have to participate. And it's not done from the outside. It's like Balenciaga, right? I mean, like they're putting all of this stuff out there front and center. You can't miss it. And if you voluntarily choose to participate, like the devil doesn't put you in a chokehold. The devil doesn't hold you down. The devil doesn't put his knee on your head and just grind your mind into obedience. It's like the vampires. Like the vampires have to be invited in. They can't just come into your house. They have to be invited in. So there are these temptations, right? There are these temptations, but the temptations are only there. That's supply. Why is the supply there? Because there's a demand, right? Why is there a drug dealer in a town? Because there are people who want drugs in the town, right? So supply doesn't create its own demand necessarily. Not always the case. I mean, the temptations to turn what is good for the group into what is pleasurable to the individual, the temptations to do that have been there forever, right? And by group, I don't mean the collective, like the nation, or just the family. The, you know, you want cheesecake in the here and now, but you're trying to lose weight. So you have cheesecake, it's pleasurable now, and then, you know, down the road, you don't lose weight, you gain weight maybe, and you're miserable, and you die early, and all this. So, I mean, these issues of, you know, you for a woman, you want a really hot guy to pay attention to you, so what do? Well, you show more skin, and then he pays attention to you, and then maybe you sleep with him, but then he moves on, and then you feel humiliated, and right, so, and you feel regret, but you've realigned your sexual market value fantasy to the point where you as a 6 can get a 10, but you can only get a 10 if you sleep with him, and then he's going to leave you, and then you get mad at men as a whole, and then you can't pair bond, and then you can't settle for a guy at your own level, and then you end up lonely and depressed and anxious, and right? So the temptation to take pleasure in the moment versus creating sustainable joy in the future, that's a story as old as humanity. Of course, right? I mean, that's a story as old as all living creatures with dimorphic sexual characteristics, right? I mean, you think those crazy birds that clear out entire areas of the forest and create little landing strips and little structures to attract the female, you think they want to be doing that? No, they're probably hungry. Rather sit on a branch and whistle, right? But no, they're driven to do all of these mating displays and shake their ass feathers and puff up their necks and, you know, make crazy rainbows out of their wings. They do all of that stuff, right? It's not what they want to be doing in the moment, but it's what nature has programmed them to do. So, yeah, so the idea that you get these images, right? You always get these images, these women and these middle-aged women. I remember this from the Glenn Close show about lawyers. I can't remember what it's called. But, you know, Glenn Close was, you know, she played a pretty horrific character as she generally does because of her own personal history. But yeah, it's this beautiful, pristine apartment, and there's a woman in a lovely dress, and she's sipping on blood red wine. It always seems to be vaguely bloody in that way. It's never white wine. But you see all these women, and this is tempting for women. It's very tempting to be pristine and isolated and beautiful and so on. But you have to succumb to that temptation. You have to succumb to that temptation. And those who do succumb to that temptation, it used to be the case that society would parade those people around as examples of people who made bad decisions. But now you don't see that stuff anymore. The women in particular who've made bad decisions are hidden from society. This is, I mean, the reason why society goes, women go invisible over 40 is not just some social thing. If they're single, right? Women go invisible over 40. If they're single, it's to hide the effects of bad decisions from the next generation so the next generation continues to make bad decisions. So you have to invite these vampires in. They don't just barge in. All right. The topic of emotional incest keeps popping up in my life. Do you have any thoughts on this? I've listened to you speak of it in other episodes, and I'm hoping for a refresher on the topic. You found a guy named Daniel Mackler. Oh, yeah, you can just search for him. He's been on my show. Yeah, emotional incest in general is the phenomenon wherein single mothers, it could be single fathers, but of course overwhelmingly it's single mothers, where single mothers treat the son as a substitute husband and require and substitute girlfriends, right? So certain women, it seems to be quite a few, I don't know the number of course, right? But certain women are just, they're just overflowing with words. They're just overflowing with words. They need to talk just about everything out. They can't hold it inside. They're just like a rumbling volcano of syllables. Just, it's a gusher. And they just need to talk everything out. Now, this is kind of alienating if you're on the receiving end and if you're a male. And I dated a girl like this once. She just needed to talk out everything. Now, as the guy with over 5,000 shows, I'm not going to complain about people who talk a lot, but I hope that it's participative. I hope that it's back and forth and you're getting stuff out of it that's mutual. I'm not just working on my own stuff. I'm trying to help your stuff too. So she just talk. And little things at work and little things with her family. And they were just little things. I mean, not big crises or anything like that. But what do you think he meant by this? But then never take your advice and all that. And I did it for a little while because, you know, you're in lust. But after a while, I just said, no, this is why God gave you girlfriends. No, it's not a male thing. This is why God, and she's really, why don't you want to support me? It's like, no, but it's just a monologue. I don't like being in situations where I have to pretend to listen. I really, really try and avoid those situations because pretending to listen or where somebody's just talking about stuff you're not particularly interested, you don't particularly care about, and or you're not allowed to respond in any way that they're going to listen to, right? Because this woman would talk about and complain about things, and then I would say, well, you know, as a man, when you hear a complaint, what do you want to do? Well, you want to help her solve the problem, right? Right. If a guy says, I can't lift this couch, what do? You jump in and help him lift the couch. You know, she says, tell me more about your feelings about not lifting the couch. So as a man, you want to solve a problem. And you want to solve a problem so that you don't get the same topic over and over again. Right. You know, if a guy complains about not having much strength, you say, you should go exercise. And then, he doesn't go and exercise. He still doesn't have much strength. He says, seriously, you men should go exercise. And then he still doesn't go exercise, still complains about not having much strength. What do? You say, I don't care. Like, stop. I gave you the solution. You don't want to do it, so don't complain to me anymore. Oh, my back hurts. Oh, do you exercise? Have you exercised? No, I'll get around to it. Oh, my back hurts. Oh, do you exercise? No, I don't want to hear any more about your back because I give you a solution and you're addicted to the problem. You don't want to solve it, so I'm not going to pretend that it's really a problem, right? If somebody keeps doing stuff that causes them problems, then they're not interested in a solution. They're addicted to the problem. And so I'm not going to listen to that. So, because, it's like women just want to be heard. It's like, okay. But being heard means what? Somebody want to help you solve the problem, right? But if people are just, vomiting up their issues and complications and messes and you can't give them any feedback or any response or anything like that, then they're just using you. I don't understand this. Really, and maybe somebody can explain it to me. My mom was this way. Like, I don't understand why you want to unpack. Like, my mom would go to these dances, and these guys would be maybe asking her out and then asking her to dance, and then they'd go sit over there, and then they'd go and talk to this person, but clearly they were just doing that to try and make her jealous, and then they'd walk back over here. And you'd get this, like, nine-dimensional post-apocalyptic chess analysis for my mom. Just, I'd be cornered and like, oh my God. Okay. And so no feedback is possible. I mean, she'd say, what do you think? And then, you know, I'm like 13. What the hell do I know? What goes on with this sort of nonsense, right? And you wouldn't give any, she wouldn't take any feedback. And I don't know why people want to unpack all of this stuff. I have no idea. Maybe it's just an exercise of power. So when you're a parent, you are there to help your children emotionally. You are there to talk to them about their own issues and problems and emotions. You're there to give them hopefully some wisdom, some instruction or whatever, right? But your children are not there for you. I mean, it's complete inversal. Your children are not there for you. Your spouse is there for you. Your friends are there for you. Your family is there for you, hopefully your family of origin. But your child is not there for you. They're not there to stopgap up the bleeding holes of your emotional dysfunction. So it's kind of like pets, right? Your pets are there for your mutual enjoyment, right? They're not there because you were too selfish to have children and now you've become a fur mama, which you're not. That's weird. And your children are not there for you. They're not there for you. You're there for them. And people, narcissistic people, have children in the belief that the children will give them meaning and fulfillment and happiness and all that. And then when they stumble across the basic and obvious fact that children are not there to give you anything, you're there to give your children everything. And, you know, there's stuff that comes back, of course, right? I mean, but it's not what it's for. And people who can't handle adult relationships, and again, I'm talking single moms here, if they can't handle adult relationships, they either had children with a bad man or drove off a good man. Well, what do you do if you're starving and you can't earn any food? Well, you steal it, generally. And then the stealing becomes a habit, right? So you steal out of desperation and then you realize that stealing is a lot easier than earning and then it becomes a habit and then you become a plague on society. And so if you can't earn somebody's respect for your personality, right? And this is the drug, right? Women can be lusted after for their bodies, but they want to be loved, like all of us do, for their personalities, right? But if you, the more you put forward your body instead of your personality, the more you attract the wrong kind of guys, and then the more bitter and negative your personality becomes, and therefore the more flesh you want to show, and therefore the more worse guys you attract, and therefore you get abandoned, and therefore you get more negative towards men, and therefore you get a more negative and caustic and bitter personality, and then you want to show even more skin because you can't attract men with your personality. It's this death spiral, literally a death spiral of the soul itself. So if you can't get a man because of the quality of your personality, you end up showing skin, offering sex. Men come, they go, they don't care, they're just there to use you and so on. And then you can't earn food. So what do you do? Well, you steal it. You steal a relationship from your son. You fasten onto your son and he becomes your companion. He becomes your pet. He becomes your exploited underling because you can't say no. And of course, the fact that this, I've known some, I wrote about this in my novel, The God of Atheists, right? The son of a single mother. It's like five people in generationals, right? It's like an inverted pyramid, right? Five people, four people, three people, two people, one person, zero people. Because the sons of single mothers, where the mother has extracted emotionally incestuous companionship from that son, almost never can form stable adult relationships. Almost, right? There's choices and self-knowledge and this and that. You got to go through a lot to be able to reclaim that. So it's using your children as a drug because you're lonely. And this does happen for fathers too. I remember seeing some super nanny many years ago where there was this guy in Alaska with a bunch of kids and he slept on the floor in the kids' room because he was lonely. Now, that didn't mean that he was doing emotional incest and so on. I just remember that. Like, she was said, why do you sleep on the kids' floor? And he wouldn't answer. And then she said, because you're lonely, right? And he's like, yeah, of course, going to, right? Loneliness is agony for people. Men can handle it slightly better, I think, than women on average. But for women in particular, loneliness is absolute torture. And I think when you have a overfull inner dialogue, what happens is you do end up discharging some of that excess, like popping a pimple almost, like you do end up discharging some of that excess onto other people against their own health. So yeah, emotional incest is really tough. And it's almost impossible to resist for a kid. It can happen with women. But what happens with the mother-daughter is when the daughter hits puberty, then boys start to be attracted to her so she can get attention outside the home. And so there's that pull to escape this vagina dentata, like this devouring mother, there's an avenue out, which is to date boys. For most boys, particularly boys raised by single mothers, so boys raised by single mothers don't get grooming tips, they don't get how to be attractive tips, and the single mothers will tell them all the wrong things about how to attract a woman if they say anything at all. And so it really is Lord of the Flies situation for those. So sons of single mothers usually don't have, unless they happen to be super attractive or whatever, like the 1 in 1,000, the 1 in 10,000 guys. But the sons of single mothers, they don't have that avenue of going out and just dating like crazy and escaping the maternal quick quagmire or quicksand that way. They are under-groomed. They are under-charismatic. They are under-confident. And it's like, well, why would I want to go just from one woman to another, right? So it really does seem to be the single mom and single son combo. It's just deadly. It is devouring a lot of... Now, again, I'm not talking about all. I'm just a general trend that I've noticed and so on, but it's really terrible. It's almost irresistible. It's very hard to escape. And this is why moms used to be encouraged to stay together with the fathers. Because if the woman has a relationship with the dad, right, with her husband, then she's not eating the sons alive. All right. Thoughts on forgiving and holding no anger. If someone had been raped, should they forgive the rapist and hold no anger towards them? It's interesting that you would focus your intellectual and emotional energies on the victim. That you, when a great, great evil has been done, a rape is one of the greatest evils in the known universe. So if a great evil has been done, you focusing on the victim strikes me as kind of cowardly. In other words, you want to lecture the victim rather than talk about the criminal. See, the victim is kind of soft and vulnerable, and you want to lecture them on the morals of the situation rather than talk about the staggering level of evil that was done unto them. So yeah, when somebody's the victim of a great evil, and your first impulse or instinct is to lecture the victim about what she should or shouldn't do, rather than rail against the evil that was done, then I think you're a moralist who prefers picking on victims and lecturing victims rather than actually standing up to abusers, which obviously is slightly more dangerous. And if you don't want that danger, that's fine. But don't lecture the victims. My God, that's wretched in my view. Don't lecture the victims. Oh, here's what you should or shouldn't do. I would never tell the victim of rape what she or he should or should not feel or do. Never. I would absolutely sympathize. I would rail against the evil that was done unto them. I would talk to them after a certain period of time about anything that they might have done that they could do differently to avoid that situation in the future, not to blame them for what happened to them, but to help them avoid it in the future. But I would just listen, and I would not lecture them about what they should or should not feel or do. Now, I don't think there's any restitution for rape. I don't think there's any restitution for rape. All right. Here we go. Satellite radio. Y'all get hit with the boom, boom. All right. Do people believe there are lies about climate change? Well, climate, I mean, this is like it's so tragic, you know, really. It's really tragic watching, with some exasperation and some patience, just watching the world try to catch up to what we were talking about like 15 years ago. Crazy. All right. Bruh, it's 3 a.m. and I gotta sleep, but I'll check your question for my laundry list. You've been reiterating that it's a normal part of life that we have to do things we don't feel like doing. Does this view change your mind about procrastination? You mentioned once a long time ago you tried implementing in your life the idea of letting go of unchosen obligations, expectations, etc. Do you remember how that went? Well, yeah, still going on, right? I dumped politics 2.5 years ago because it just became so boring. So I did a video. You can check it out. It's called The Truth About Procrastination, fdrpodcasts.com. That's a great search engine. I'm sorry about the last show. I accidentally deleted it. I put it back up. So procrastination is what happens when you are ordered to do things with no context, no meaning, and no value to you, which is most of our childhoods. Right? Just ordered to do things, study this, take this test, do this, do that. And you don't, you very rarely appreciate it, and you don't want to do it. You don't see the value in doing it. And you're just doing it because you're ordered to do it, and you'll be punished if you don't do it. So your free will is taken from you, and all that is substituted is brute mammalian punishment and rewards, carrots and sticks. So when you are bullied into doing things you don't care about when you're a kid, then you grow up resenting obligations. Of course, right? Why wouldn't you? Would be crazy if you didn't. So because you grew up resenting obligations, everything in your life becomes an obligation. You don't generate your own tasks. You just respond to tasks coming in like cattle prods or baseball bats or fish hooks or whatever. You sit there inert and you wait for people to demand things of you, and then you resentfully do them because that's what you've been trained to do as a kid for many, many years. So when you generate your own path and your own goals, then things don't feel as much like have-tos. It's want-tos, right? I love doing these shows, love having these conversations with you guys. It's a great pleasure and joy of mine. I think it's very good for the world. It's very good for me. It's very good for you, I hope. So the fact that there's boring stuff to do, you know, I mean, an afterlife that is neutral, not hugely negative, but not positive, it will be me editing podcasts for infinity, right? That's what I'll be doing in the afterlife, if there's some sort of entropy afterlife. So, but you know, it doesn't enrage me. I mean, I do the shows and then I'll do the edits and clean up the audio and publish. And, you know, it's really, really boring. And it's gotten, you know, it's worse now because I'm scattered on 50 million different platforms and all that. So I don't hate it. It's not a big deal. It's just part of, you know, well, it's not much point recording the shows if I don't publish them, and I'd rather them be cleaned up so they're more of a pleasure to listen to and so on. So I don't procrastinate that stuff because it's not forced upon me. It's the inevitable consequence of me wanting to do what I do. So procrastination is when you simply have the attitude when it becomes a big problem, and everybody procrastinates a little bit, that's fine. But procrastination becomes a big issue when you don't generate any of your own internal goals, desires, projects, and you are simply responding to necessity in a resentful manner. Why do I have a job? Oh, because I got to pay my bills. Okay, I got to pay my bills. I'll go to the job. I don't really like the job. I don't like my employer. I don't like the job that I do. I don't like the work. It doesn't mean anything to me, but I got to pay my bills. And right, and you come home and I got to take the garbage out. I don't really care. Like, you're just grumbling your way through life. And it's tragic. And I have great sympathy for that. It just comes out of being told what to do all the time as a kid, not having anything explained to you and simply power or authority being exercised over you. Now, the moment you say, I don't have to do shit. I don't have to do anything. I don't have to do diddly squat. And you don't. You don't have to get out of bed tomorrow. You don't have to go to bed tonight. You don't have to do anything. There are consequences, and I think some of them can be pretty dire, but you don't have to do anything. You don't have to eat. You don't have to drink. You don't have to do anything. Now, once you say, okay, I'm going to blank slate this stuff, right? And I'm going to figure out what I want to do with my life, and you start generating your own goals and projects. You know, if you love drawing, then, you know, start drawing and get into that. If you love piano, then play piano and start getting into that and figure out if there's a way that you can monetize that. You could write songs or sell your art or something like that. Just figure out something you can do. And then you're generating your own goals. And why would you want to procrastinate on something you genuinely want to do? Accepting that there are things in what you want to do that are difficult and unpleasant, right? If you're an artist, you're probably better at drawing than selling. So you got to learn how to sell. I understand that. It's not pleasant. But there's little point being an artist, if you can't sell your art, then you're just a hobbyist, right? It's just like doing puzzles, like jigsaw puzzles, just killing time. So, yeah, I don't have to do squat. I could shut this live stream down. I could walk away from the show and I could never broadcast anything ever again. Ever. I don't have to do any of this at all. There would be some positive consequences of that. There would be some significant negative consequences to that. But I don't have to do any of these shows. Right? I didn't even schedule this show today. I mean, I have the Loosey Goosey Wednesday nights and Friday nights, 7 p.m. But I did a 2.5 hour call-in show yesterday with a guy who was raised by two alcoholics who drank mimosas in the morning. Right? I mean, that guy needed some serious listening. I mean, it was really tough. He was thinking of abandoning his family because he had concerns about his level of anger towards his newborn. I could say no to all of that. I could just, nah, I'd rather play Neverwinter Nights Enhanced Edition or whatever, right? So I don't have to do any of that. I don't have to sit here. I don't have to talk to you. I don't have to publish anything. I don't have to do anything. I mean, I could certainly say, look, I spent 40 years in the trenches, which I have spent 40 years in the trenches fighting against anti-rational, collectivist, evil forces in my private life, in my business life, in my public life. I put in my 40 years, and 40 years in the army is, I mean, 20 years in the army, you can retire with full pension, right? I've been doing this 40 years. I certainly wouldn't say to myself if I quit after 40 years, well, you didn't give it your all. It's like, no, man, I gave it my all. So I could, again, shut this right down, you know, hand over the lens. I could just shut this whole thing down right now and walk away and never do. I'd find something else to do with my life, find some other way to make money, whatever it is, right? But I don't have to do any of this. Emails come in, I don't have to respond. People complain, I don't have to listen. People ask for help, I don't have to offer. I don't have to do a damn thing. That's my day. I don't have to do it. Do I want to do it? Will it be meaningful to me? Will it be helpful to me and to the world? And the world is important. It's important. I mean, I think I do have certain gifts, and I did not earn these gifts. I harnessed and polished and sharpened those gifts. But that's like a guy with a great voice taking singing lessons, right? The singing lessons are important to keep the great voice, but you're just born with a great voice. Like, I mean, a friend of mine who's a musician, when he was younger, he played a lot of bars, and he said the funny thing is, you know, I just wrecked my voice every weekend. And he said the worst part of it was I would actually wreck my voice talking to people between the sets when the music being played over the speakers was really loud. But so he had to, you know, work to preserve his instrument. He's got a very nice singing voice, great musician. And so, yeah, he took singing lessons, and I've studied philosophy, but he took singing lessons because he had a great voice, and I study philosophy because I have a smart brain to begin with. I've certainly done, so I think if you have those kinds of gifts, then I didn't earn them, and because I didn't earn them, it's kind of accidental. I think it's the honorable thing to do, the decent thing to do, the right thing to do, is to put those gifts in service to the world as best I can. That's the general goal. I have a good analogy I have a good capacity to generate spontaneously metaphors and analogies that are very clarifying on the fly. I'm a really good debater. I'm good at doing these role plays. I've, of course, got theater training and improv training and all of that. So I have a pleasant speaking voice. And, of course, I took voice training for 2 years when I was in theater school. So I know how to use it well in my audiobooks and all of that. And just in general, I have a very sort of flexible instrument that's pleasant. So I feel that there's a certain obligation. If you have gifts that help the world that you did not build yourself. I didn't build my brain myself. My brain, like everybody's brain, named itself. I think there's an obligation, but that's not a have to. That's still a voluntary. Because the moment I start to see it as an obligation, well, I have to drag myself down to do a show because it's good for the world and I didn't earn my brain, right? Then the shows lose all value. The only way that I can maintain value in what I'm doing is I don't have to do it. I don't have to do it. Otherwise, I'm bullying myself. Well, you're selfish if you take your gifts and withhold them from the world and you've got an obligation. Okay, then it becomes a have to and I don't want to do it and I fight against it and I lose all of that spontaneous generation and creativity that happens when you're playing, as children play very seriously. Children play very seriously and adults should do the same. The moment it becomes an obligation, this show loses all value. And I think if you look at your own life, where you feel a sense of obligation, there you have a soulless dead spot in your life. a place where because you're passive, like because you were bullied as a kid, you become passive as an adult. And because you're passive as an adult, you can't generate your own goals. And therefore, everything becomes a have to. And you resent it all. And because you resent it all and you're negative, you then become somebody that positive and enthusiastic managers don't want to hire. So you end up being hired by the dregs and the people who are depressed themselves. And you just end up in that whole circle. And you don't have enthusiastic people around you because your negativity drains them of their enthusiasm. And lack of energy, lack of motivation is a social contagion. And in the battle between their enthusiasm and your depression, they're concerned that their enthusiasm is going to lose out. And so they have to avoid you. And so you end up in this whole circle of people who are like you, and it's really tough to break out. And then it becomes existential. It's the human condition. It's like, no, it's because you were bullied as a kid, which I hugely sympathize for. It's terrible. We should not raise kids that way at all. But because you were bullied as a kid, you became inert and you became lazy, really, with regards to generating, not lazy as a kid, because as a kid, you're just trying to survive, but lazy as an adult. You don't generate your own goals because You just sit there and wait for obligations to hit you, and then you resentfully comply, and you do that until the final obligation comes along and you die. So don't do that. My suggestion. All right, let's see here. Slow down. She don't take no prisoner. She gotta give me the business. All right. The very definition of hat here. Yeah, I suppose, right? Why do people avoid responsibility? Because responsibility, I just talked about this on Friday, because responsibility is a word that means the infliction of punishment by the powerful on the weak. Right? The infliction of power. So when you say to someone, you have a responsibility for, what you're describing is you have power and they don't. So you can inflict responsibility on the helpless, but you can't inflict responsibility on the powerful, because the whole point of power is to avoid consequences and responsibility. Completely avoid it. So if you fail to study for a test as a kid, then you get an F, you get a fail. And people say, well, you were responsible for studying, right? I just did this role play yesterday with this guy who had the parents, right? So when he was a kid, if he did things that were bad, if he did things that were wrong, if he did things his parents didn't approve of, then they would punish him. Because he had a responsibility to do the right things. They'd already told him. And of course, we all know this, right? If your dad, when you're a kid, your dad or your mom says, you got a test in a month. It's really, really important. You got to study for it. You're going to study for it? Yeah, I'm going to study for it. Okay. You got a test in 3 weeks. You're going to study for it? Yeah, I'm going to study for it. 2 weeks. Yeah, I'm going to study for it. Test is in a week, 5 days, 3 days. Tomorrow's you're going to study. And then you fail the test. You come home and you got to get your parent to sign the test. You failed. You said, I told you this for a month. You said you were going to study. You knew it was important. Did you study? No, I didn't really study. Well, you're punished because you failed. You didn't, right? You didn't do the work. You didn't study, right? Now, this guy's parent was, I think, in my opinion, a pretty bad parent. And so in the role play, I said, well, you punished me for not studying for tests when I was a kid. You knew for at least 9 months that you were going to be a dad. You knew that you had a bad childhood yourself. So, Dad, what books on parenting did you read? You knew you had bad parenting yourself, so you knew you didn't have a good template. You knew for at least 9 months that you were going to be a father. What books on parenting did you read? When things were going awry, when the house was chaotic and violent, what books on parenting did you read? What therapy did you access, right? So you've got a test called parenting. And how many parents pass the test called parenting? Pass the test. I mean, you can give me your guesses of percentage of how many parents pass the test called parenting, which means that they don't use violence, they don't use intimidation, they don't use size and strength and power and authority. They reason with their kids, they raise happy, confident, positive kids who will avoid evil and pursue good. How many parents pass the test of parenting? Now, what are the negative consequences of failing the test of parenting. The parents who inflict negative consequences on their kids for failing the test, you know, the F, I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times, you know, they, you got to clean your bathroom, you got to take out the garbage, you got to vacuum, and, oh, why do I have to nag you, right? You're mad at your kids for failing to do the right thing. How come you had the test, you didn't study? What's the matter with you? You knew it was important. I have no sympathy. So parents who inflict responsibility on their children, you got to be responsible. I own what you do. Okay. Well, let's say they were bad parents, right? Let's say they hit, they screamed at, verbally abused, God knows what else, right? So if you're going to punish an 8-year-old kid or a 10-year-old kid for failing to do well on a test about algebra or the names of the oceans or some stupid spelling bee, you're going to punish a kid for failing to take responsibility for not studying for a super important test when he was 10 years old. Okay, and then that kid comes to you as an adult and says, well, you had a test called parenthood. You didn't even study. Which is more important, knowing the names of 12 oceans or being a good parent? You didn't even study for So, of course, by this logic, the parent should accept any and all punishment for failing to study and succeed at the test called parenting. But they don't. The moment you hold parents accountable for bad parenting, they get enraged. It's like, well, wait a minute. You got mad at me when I was 10 years old for not studying for a test. You didn't even learn how to be a good parent. Slightly more important. And so you understand, responsibility is just a cover word for I can punish you because I'm bigger and stronger. And so that's accountability, right? So people avoid responsibility because the word has been corrupted to mean I can abuse you because I have power. And the way that I'm going to abuse you is to say that you lack responsibility. But if you ever try and hold me accountable for my abuses of power, I will never submit to that. I will fight that to the death. So a parent will punish a child for failing to study for an exam. And when the child asks the parent, how did you study for the test called parenthood? What did you read? What experts did you consult and all of that? How did you learn? Well, the parent says, A, I wasn't a bad parent, and B, even if you have some complaints, it's all in the past and you should move on, and C, I can't change the past even if I did. D, what do you want from me? And E, I did the best I could with the knowledge I had. To which, of course, the child, adult child, can reasonably say, well, wait a minute, if I didn't study for a test, I was doing the best I could with the knowledge I had. Ah, but you didn't study. Okay, so the fact that I didn't study matters. So the fact that you say, well, I did the best I could with the knowledge I had, you never would have given me that excuse when I was a kid if I didn't study for an exam and then I failed that exam and I said, hey, man, it's in the past. I can't change the past. We got to just move on. And hey, when I was doing that exam, I did the best I could with the knowledge I had. It's like, well, why didn't you have more knowledge? Why didn't you study for it? I told you to study for it. You knew you were supposed to study for it. You knew the test was coming. Why did you have so little knowledge? No, I did the best I could with it. So parents then deploy excuses against adult children, questioning them, that the children would never have been able to use as children. In other words, the parents are claiming excuses for actions they took when they were 30 or 40 that they never would have accepted from their children when their children were 5 or 10 or 15. I mean, it's just mad. So responsibility, if you're a politician and a policy doesn't work out, what are the consequences? What are the consequences? Now, people saying, the vaccine stopped transmission. That was never tested for. What are the consequences? What are the consequences for the invasion of Iraq based upon the lie that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction? What are the consequences? No, you see, consequences and responsibility, they're for children taking bullshit tests when they're 10 years old. That's accountability. That's responsibility. Boy, war criminals, they get a pension. I shouldn't laugh, but I mean, it's insane. This is why I wrote my novel, The Future, freedomain.locals.com. Please, God, go and get that book. FUMU, fuck up, move up. Peter Principle. Everybody's promoted one layer beyond their level of competence. Responsibility, to take responsibility is a confession of low status. High status people don't take responsibility. It's the whole point of high status is you get to inflict responsibility on others. You don't take responsibility yourself. My God. I mean, the first thing that people do when they have power is demand that they are not held accountable. I mean, explicitly or implicitly, the whole structure of power is set up so that you can't hold powerful people accountable. I mean, what business people do is they set up entire layers of support people so you can never talk to the person who made a bad decision that cost you money. No, there's no accountability. So people avoid responsibility because they haven't identified, I think consciously, that responsibility is just a low status word. You avoid responsibility because human beings are programmed to avoid signals of low status for the most part. All right. Great answer to my question, Steph. Thank you. All right. All right. Children are meant to be seen and not heard, and respect your elders were the most aggravating things my dad would utter when I was growing up. I can't imagine the bottomless, vacant, interstellar emptiness of a soul that demands respect from a child. It's the most pathetic thing that I'm, honestly, it's the most pathetic, degenerate, horrendous, bottomlessly vacuous things to demand respect from a child. Child is not there to give you respect. God. I mean, I think if you earn respect, then your child should, over time, pay it. But you can't demand it. You can't demand respect. Yeah, respect your elders. The only reason that you would demand respect is you haven't earned it. Of course. Of course. I mean, it's a confession that you are not worthy of respect the moment you demand it. Children are meant to be seen and not heard. Yeah, so when your mom or your dad who told you that, say your mom told you that, children are meant to be seen and not heard. She calls you up in a panic because something bad has happened. She calls you on video. Just mute your responses. Just nod. You can see me. Can't hear me. I'm muted because children are meant to be seen and not heard. She would consider that really rude. Why? Because now she needs you to talk because she needs something, right? Oh, I forgot. You know everything. Room temperature IQ level parents. I think that's below room temperature, but yeah. My mother doesn't listen to me when I give advice on her mental and emotional health, but when a doctor tells her to do something for her physical health, she asks me what she should do. Why might she trust my judgment for medical advice, not a doctor, but not for her mental well-being? Ah, well, here we get into the vast, cavernous, deep, and gelatinous cube, belly of the beast, murky nonsense swamp known as female relationships between unconscious and the body. Ooh, man, these are depths that we only dare gaze at in wonder from orbit. No man goes down into these swamps and emerges as anything other than a estrogen chewed up skeleton remnant. You do not go deep into this quagmire of women's relationship with the unconscious and the body. You know, for men, what's that line from Seinfeld? Man's body is like, it's utilitarian. It's like a Jeep. Yeah, I don't, manifest psychosomatic, blah, blah, blah. But women and their unconscious and their body is a very deep and murky topic. And in all seriousness, you can't explore it. Because the many countless sane women in the world don't experience this murky relationship between the unconscious and the body. And the women who are crazy will never tell you the truth about it, so it is probably going to remain an eternal mystery for mankind. Why is it that women who are dysfunctional manifest so many psychosomatic symptoms? I don't know. It certainly seems to be more than men, or maybe men just eventually have one giant heart gasket blowout and sail off the River Styx with half a smile on their face to escape this core of troubled souls. But yeah, women and what happens with their bodies. Unconscious dysfunction seems to translate into physical dysfunction for women at a higher rate than men. This goes all the way back to Freud, who's not a guy I hugely respect, but you know, he did sort of notice this as well. So as far as if your mother doesn't listen when you give advice on mental and emotional health, I don't know why women in general seem to be slightly more uncoachable than men. And maybe it's simply to do with the fact that for men, like for boys when we're growing up, we want to participate in sports. Now, if we suck at those sports, we're less likely to be able to participate in them, so we take some coaching. We either implicitly, like we look at the boys who do better and we try and do better, we learn to adapt and adjust our own behavior in order to be better at sports. I remember going through this process. Or, and I also went through this process as well, we get coaching. Right. I mean, I was a pretty good tennis player when I was a kid, and I took the coaching on how to become a better tennis player. And then I coached, I helped a friend coach a soccer team years ago. And so you just used to getting coaching, and it's not humiliating. In fact, being coached is a sign of value. Right. You're coached because you have potential and you just need to manifest it. So you learn how to become better at sports because you want to participate in sports. Now, girls, and again, there are some girls who are fantastic at sports. You got to watch some of these amazing girls with their volleyball gets. I mean, it's wild. You think it's completely impossible to get the shot, and they're just diving all over the place on their grasshopper legs, and it's really something to see. But girls generally participate in competitive sports less than boys, certainly in the pickup games. You know, when I played as a kid and as a teenager, we played endless games of soccer and baseball and other things. And those pickup games were legion. I never knew girls to have pickup games. I never knew girls to do that kind of stuff. I'm sure they did, but I just didn't know of it and didn't hear of it. And so I think that boys are just more used to being coached. Like our general status is I'm bad at stuff. And if I want to become good at stuff, I got to practice. But for girls, that doesn't seem to be the same thing. So boys are tempered by a lot of coaching, a lot of feedback. And of course, we are treated more harshly in school. So we have to work that much harder to get things than girls do. And we know this because when you take identifying marks off boys and girls tests and you give it to teachers so they don't know if it's a boy or a girl, then the boys are scored higher, right? If the boys are identified as boys, they're scored lower and the girls are scored higher. So we have sexist, rampant, virtually intractable discrimination against boys in school. So we just have to work that much harder, and we are in a results-based environment. Right? But men are always in a results-based environment. Women are in an intention-based environment. Women judge by intention, men judge by results. And that's because for a man, I didn't mean to is never an excuse. For a woman, I didn't mean to is generally an excuse. So women have a defense called I didn't mean to. In other words, women have a defense called good intentions. Boys don't have a defense called good intentions at all. We don't have a defense. This is really something fundamental to understand about the difference between boys and girls and how we evolve, at least develop in current society. So if you're a boy and you're supposed to produce something, either for boys or your parents or your group or whatever, right? And you have good intentions but bad outcomes, nobody cares. You know, if you fail to score the goal in a very important soccer match and you say, well, I meant to score, I meant to hit it in, nobody cares. Well, you didn't, but you didn't. Nobody cares about your intentions. Now, if you're a girl, though, people really care about your intentions to the point where lack of intention becomes an excuse. I didn't mean to. It was an accident. I didn't intend to. It wasn't my. I didn't want that. Oh, okay. So girls live in a world of intentionality because intentionality is a get out of jail free card, which boys don't have. We don't have a get out of jail free card because we're measured by consequences. We're measured by output. We're measured by outcome. We're not measured by intention, which is why when you get female voters, you get a bunch of government agencies that never achieve what they claim they do, but they say, well, they mean well. But he means well. No, he means well. You can't eat intention. So when men are out there hunting, they either come home with some food or they don't. I meant to get food. you can't, like, men's value don't rest on intentions. They rest on outcomes. And again, I'm not complaining. I'm simply, you know, pointing out a sort of basic fact. So because women have this get out of jail free card called intentionality. Oh, I never meant to. I did the best I could. Or that was never my goal. I never meant to hurt you. You all hear these things, right? And women say it not because it's even remotely true, but because it gets them off the hook. I never meant to. And of course, intention, right? It's the whole Hillary Clinton thing, right? Intention is non-empirical. You can't measure intention. You know, so it becomes subjective soup that's an endless excuse factory, which, you know, and I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong to allow for intentionality to be an endless amount of excuse, because it keeps people children, whether they're male or female. It keeps them as children. Right? As children, intention matters. As adults, outcome matters, right? And the cry of the single mother. Well, I didn't mean to end up as a single mother. I didn't want to end up as a single mother. It was just that bad guy, right? What? The effect is that you ended up as, if you were judging them by the male standard, be like, I don't care what your intention was, you ended up as a single mother. But there's this meme on the internet about some woman who's a single mother saying, well, we're not going to judge on looks anymore, we're going to judge on qualities of character, and blah, 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 blah. And then somebody replied underneath, be nice if you did that before you became a single mother. But the women can play helpless and intention and sadly, and, you know, again, it's not an issue between males and females, and it's not negative towards females. The state corrupts everything, but women can play in the intention game, right? So if you're trying to give your mother advice on mental and emotional health, you're saying to her, here's how to become a stronger person in terms of mentality, right? But to become a stronger person would be to take ownership, to take responsibility, to accept free will. And that's not where the strength of women is these days. Right? A woman's weakness is her actual strength. So if you're saying to a woman who's dysfunctional, well, here's how to become a strong, empowered, mature, free will, self-responsible, actualized woman. Well, you're taking away her excuse machine. And if it's your mother, she's made a lot of big decisions based on having that infinite excuse machine of intentionality and distress and didn't know and, right? Imagine if ignorance of the law was actually an excuse. Like, you could never be convicted of a law you didn't know. And there was some magic machine that could read your thoughts about whether you knew. Look at me creating these great analogies on the fly. So if ignorance of the law, you could never be prosecuted for any law you didn't know existed. Would you want to learn a lot about the law? No. Because your get out of jail free card, your immunity from prosecution card would be diminished. Why would you want to learn about the law if once you learn about the law, you're now subject to the law? Would you rather have a free-for-all where you do whatever you want and then say, "Ooby, I didn't know." And then they'd, oh, well, you didn't know. Okay, off you go. Right? Ignorance of the law is a total excuse. So if you're going to, and it's not just about women, it's about men and women. If you're going to go to your mom and you're going to say, oh, mom, here's how you have maturity and responsibility. Then her instinct is like, oh, wait, then I can't use excuses. I can't use intentionality. I can't use I didn't know. I can't use fogging and gaslighting. Thank you. I mean, no, I don't want that, because my power is in my fragility, right? So now with regards to physical health, see, physical health is empirical, it's measurable. And so it's consequential, right? So if you want to give her advice on her mental health, she's going to reject it, because that's going to diminish her power, her get out of jail free cards, to educate her on the law, which she's now then subject to. She doesn't want that. But with regards to physical health, she's coming to you for that because that's empirical and that's evidence-based. So as a man, she doesn't want you dealing with her power of intentionality, but she's more than happy to go to you to defer for consequential effects like physical health. My daughter is meeting a young man she's interested in. She wants to discuss how he would raise his children. He was raised religious. She's really nervous and would like your advice. She's listening with me now. Well, hello. And very nice to meet you. Thank you so much for dropping by. Look at that. We're talking about church on Sunday morning. It's still Sunday morning? No, it's Sunday afternoon now. All right. So with regards to raising children, there are two aspects to religion when it comes to raising children. The first aspect is morality and empathy. These are very, very good. And Christianity is hands down the best at this, in my humble opinion. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Love your neighbor as yourself. All of the commandments of God to have empathy and to have a universal set of morals that apply to believer and non-believer alike. Christian ethics are the closest to UPB that can be conceived of without tipping over into rampant rationalism. So if his goal with instruction is universal moral instruction, then you're better off with him than with 99.999% of atheists, unbelievers, blasphemers, skeptics, whatever you want to call them. So if the goal is God is universal morality, God is empathy, and God is respect for virtue and all of that, then you're going to be better off with him than just about every other atheist in the known universe. If, on the other hand, the second part of religious instruction is, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child, I'm going to beat the devil out of them, and I know that's an extreme position, but if there is this Old Testament punitive aspect to things, then what he's looking to is to emulate the Old Testament God, who's a bit of a vainglorious guy, to put it mildly, and he recognized that by promising after the flood with the rainbow to not ever drown humanity again, however many people might wish for it these days. So if he's moral instruction religion guy, I'd say give him a shot. If he is a punitive Old Testament, spare the rod, spoil the child, punishment guy, I would not give him the time of day. So, will you ever take an IQ test? Do you think it's useful information for people in general to know? I don't. I can't imagine that I would take an IQ test in any particular way. The reason being that an IQ test would distract from me. And I don't mean me, like, think about me, but my arguments, right? So let's say I take an IQ test and I have an IQ of 180. Okay. Well, then some people would accept as what I'm saying is true because I have a very high IQ. And look, I think in terms of verbal IQ, it's kind of tough to look up and see a lot of people, but you can be the judge of that better than I can because I'm in the experiment known as me. So if my IQ was very, very high, then people would defer not to my arguments, which means they wouldn't be thinking for themselves. They would defer to the high IQ, which is not philosophical. If my IQ is more specialized and doesn't show up as particularly high, then people would use that as a reason to dismiss my arguments rather than evaluate them, which again, would not be thinking for themselves. I can't imagine any situation where me taking an IQ test would result in more people thinking for themselves. All right. Very few good parents in the world. Well, I certainly think by future standards, they'll look back and look back with horror. A lot of Christian philosophers say to forgive and hold no anger towards anyone because anger is a way to control you. Anger leads to violence and is not for God. Isn't rape a test of forgiveness, like a natural disaster or being... Well, okay, so anger is a way to control you. Well, Jesus was perfect, and Jesus got angry. I mean, he took a whip to the money changers, but Jesus absolutely got angry. So if Jesus is perfect and Jesus gets angry, if God is moral and God gets angry, then the people who tell you never to get angry are telling you to not do what God and Jesus did. Now, if that's not devilish, I don't know what is. Like the argument against anger is the argument against morality. Morality is enforced in many instances in the Christian universe through anger. God smites, God strikes, Jesus whips, Jesus is angry. So there are times to be angry and there are times to forgive. I had a guy email me this morning and he is somebody who has trolled me mercilessly for years in the most hostile and destructive manner possible. And he wrote me a long letter this morning to apologize. He just realized how right I was about things based upon his own personal experience. And he, you know, really on his knees, you know, you could hear the tears coming from his face as he wrote the email. And I wrote back to him and I said, let's do a call-in show that's very honorably spoken. It's very honorably spoken and very vulnerable and very powerful to write to someone you've wronged for many years and say, I'm desperately sorry you were right. I don't know what I can do. I know you. He said, I know you don't forgive people. And it's like, no, I mean, I pay my debts. You know, if I order something and it comes, I'll pay. And if somebody apologizes, makes restitution and, you know, knows we know how it's not going to do again, that's a forgiveness worthy. I mean, so we'll see. We'll see. Now, when anger becomes rage, then that becomes bad. But anger is absolutely one of the central emotions subject to the Aristotelian mean. It's like courage. If you don't have any courage or you have too little courage, you're a coward. If you have too much courage, you're foolhardy and you rush in where angels fear to tread and you end up, hobbled, right? Like, I mean, if you're a First World War trench guy, I mean, taking out all the moral ambiguity of the First World War trench guy, you don't rush the German machine gun nests alone, or the British or French for that matter, because you're just going to get killed. That's an excess of courage. That's foolhardiness. With anger, if you have a deficiency of anger, you just get pushed around all the time. If you have an excess of anger, you become an abuser. I mean, anyone can get angry, but getting angry in the right way at the right time, for the right effect, for the right outcome, expressed in the right way, that's complicated. That's a challenge. So people who just want to get rid of anger, well, I assume, you know, like all the people who were like, wait, Twitter's dealing with child sex abuse material. I'm out of here. It's like, I think you want to delete your account so people don't see your history. I don't know. But people who want to disarm you are planning on doing things that you oppose. Somebody who wants to tell you, or somebody who tells you never get angry, is about to do something that an honorable person would get angry about. It's a foreshadow of imminent exploitation. So I don't think it's right. All right, what do we got here? 17 minutes. Man, this time flies. Is it just me? Maybe it's just me, but time does seem to fly like an eagle. All right. Rage is so when if you express anger in a sort of healthy and positive way over the course of your life, then you're fine. Rage generally comes out when you've suppressed your anger for a long time and then you just blow up. All right, let's see here. Yeah, the rod was actually the shepherd's tool that was used to guide, pull, and catch sheep in the field, not whip. Yeah, good shepherd, for sure. All right, let's see here. Yeah, I didn't mean to hurt you. It's trying to draw you into the subjective, unprovable swamp of intention. And I will not get drawn into intention conversations with people. I think it's an insult to us both. Let's see here. Yeah, anger is self-defense. I mean, anger is self-defense. For your philosopher series, could you please cover Seneca? I probably will. Well, finish the series up to the modern age, probably early next year. And then I'll have a voting system for people I missed. So we'll get to that. All right, let's see here. Yeah, anger is self-defense. Rage is the obliteration of the other. Hi, Steph. Our three-year-old sometimes hits my face when she does not get her way. It has occurred less lately, but I still feel unsure how to handle it when it does. Once I gave her a symbolic slap back, which I immediately regretted. Yeah, that makes sense. Now I just keep repeating how it makes me feel and that I don't like it. Is there anything else I can do? Many thanks. Well, she's three, and I assume she's smart. obviously you're a listener, so I would just ask her the philosophical questions. Are we allowed to hit? And remember, it's not just you. Are we all allowed to hit? If you hit me, can I hit you? Are we allowed to hit? Is hitting okay? I can't just have one rule for you, and right? What if a friend of yours hits you? Do you want me to intervene? Do you want me to stop that friend from hitting you? Is hitting okay? Do we hit? It's UPB 101, right? And she's 3. She can absolutely have this conversation. Do we hit? Is hitting okay? Is hitting good? Are we allowed to hit? Now, she wants to have a rule called no hitting, which exempts herself. Right? That's the instinct of power. And, you know, 3-year-olds want power, just like everyone. There's nothing wrong with that. So she is going to have a desire for power. And power is, well, I can hit, but you can't. I can hit, but no one else can. I can hit, but if someone hits me, I want you to intervene and stop them, right? And say, no, come on. We're people. Are we allowed to hit? Well, children are allowed to hit. She'll try that. Okay, so if another kid hits you, I won't do anything because I won't say, I won't protect you, right? Oh, no, I want you. Right, so you just, she needs to, she's in the process of developing concepts, right, at 3, and abstractions and universals. So talking about your feelings, of course she knows that you don't like being hit. So telling her you don't like it, because she's, when she doesn't get what she wants, she hits you because she knows you don't like it. So telling her that you don't like it is not telling her anything she doesn't already know. She's hitting you because you don't like it. So you have to remove the exemption that she's created for herself, right? So if your child hits you, you say, oh, are we hitting now? Is that the thing? Are we going to hit? Now, look, she's not going to say yes, obviously, right? She's going to, right, and say, well, wait, no, no. And you can have that philosophical conversation. Now, what she's going to do, I guarantee you what she's going to do, is she's going to pretend that she can't really hear you. She just pretend that she doesn't understand or anything like that, right? And you just have to be patient and say, no, I'm not leaving this conversation. Like, we're going to talk till we sort this out, right? I know you can hear me. Hello. Like if I said, would you like some candy? You're going to look up, right? So you just make it funny, right? So she's not going to want to give up her exemption to the rule, because the rule in the family is no hitting. She loves to have an exemption. That's power seeking. There's nothing wrong with that. Kids will always do that, and it's perfectly healthy. Nothing wrong with what she's doing. And so that's number one, is are we hitting? Are we going to hit? Because you hit. Does that mean hitting's okay? Right? She won't want to hold on to the hitting, right? That's number one. Number two, have you trained her to hit you? A big question, right? Have you trained her to hit you? In other words, does she get her way when she hits you? Because if you reward her by giving her what she wants when she hits you, you're just training her to hit you more. So you've got to stop that completely. The moment that she hits you, she gets nothing that she wants, nothing. And she gets a lecture or a conversation or a set of questions, right? I mean, you have these questions about lying, right? I write about this in my novel, The Future. All right, let's see here. I didn't mean to sleep with the mailman. It just happened. Oh, yeah, it just happened. You know, I didn't mean to. It's like conversations about intentionality are worse than useless. They're an insult to empiricism, to facts, to reality, to respect. Everybody tries it. Let's see here. You can tip me. Yes, you can tip me right here, right now. Come on, this is great stuff. You know it. All right. What's your opinion on electoral unions and the trade? I've heard you briefly mention them in your podcast. Do you have any general thoughts or insights on this sector? Well, I mean, about abstract unions as a whole, unions are perfectly valuable entities to negotiate on behalf of people who may not have negotiation skills themselves, right? I mean, I hire an electrician when I have electrical work to do, because I'm not an electrician. I'm just going to electrocute myself. And electricians are not experts at negotiation of salary or work conditions or benefits or pensions or whatever, so they're going to hire people. And the best way to do that is for the electrical unions, electricians to pool themselves together and to form a union. That's perfectly fine. Voluntary association, right? Violations of voluntary association or violations of free association. So electricians can all get together and they can say, this is what we want or we won't work. That's fine. However, they cannot morally go to the government and say, unless you have this piece of paper and all agree with us and do everything we want, you can't be an electrician. That's not right, because that's using government force for a monopoly, and a monopoly is immoral. It's the same thing with unions in a factory. You got a factory with 100 workers, the workers can form a union, perfectly fine. Free association, they can all get together and they can all say we're going to go on strike. And they can all walk out if they don't want to keep working, they want to go on strike, totally fine. Nobody can force you to go to work unless you've signed some kind of contract. So unions are perfectly fine. Where unions tip over into immorality is when they use violence, either explicitly or implicitly through the state. They use violence to prevent other people from replacing them, right? The strike breakers, they call them scabs, right? Which is a pretty dehumanizing word, right? So if a bunch of workers go on strike, they have a lot of leverage, right? If you got 100 workers and they all go on strike, that's a lot of leverage for the factory owner, and he's going to have to listen to them and do what, just to some degree, what they want, not to the point where they go out of business, but whatever, right? However, if the factory workers, all 100 of them, can go on strike and they can use the power of violence, either through the state or individually, to prevent any other workers from coming in and working, then that's a hostage situation. They've completely taken this guy's life savings and his factory totally hostage, and that's absolutely immoral. So collective action's fine, just can't use force. All right, let's see here. Oh my God, really? 8 minutes left. All right. Let's see here. Let's get to our last questions. Any thoughts on what the economy will look like in 2023? Might be worth getting some food in the basement. I'm writing about all of this in my new book. Thoughts on psychiatry. Violate civil rights by locking people up against their will on medical grounds. Diagnosis based on subjective measures. I see a huge lack of focus in looking into people's past and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So, talk therapy is a wonderful gift to mankind. And I interviewed a guy many years ago who said that talk therapy was about the best thing you could spend your money on in order to bring sustainable happiness. And the $20,000 that I spent on talk therapy many years ago was the best money I ever spent in my life. And I'm a massive fan of really good, competent talk therapy. It's amazing and wonderful. When psychiatry starts to involve drugs, I have my issues, right? And the whole serotonin deficiency theory has been recently disproven, although, again, I was talking about this many, many years ago. But yeah, I have and we'll talk about the Soviet Union, which is where this stuff became a black art. So when the government gets to define people through regulated professionals as mentally ill and then drug them, then absolutely it's going to be used as a method of control. It's way too much power to have some subject. I'm going to call you X, and because of X, I'm going to drug you. And I can force this. That's way too much power for any human being to have. Way too much power. So I'm not a fan, of course, of the union of mental health professionalism plus the state and forced medications are, it's the whole Nuremberg principle, right? So I think it's bad. All right. Not trying to spam, not sure if you missed it. If you and your partner both have abusive parents who didn't make restitution and you defoo and your partner doesn't defoo, what does this mean? Why are you asking me? Understand, what am I missing here? What does this mean? It means that your partner doesn't agree with you. I'm not sure what. So if you maybe I'm missing something here. If you and your partner both have abusive parents who didn't make restitution, in other words, the abuse continues and there's no apology, there's no restitution, there's no right, and the abuse continues, and you defoo, you separate from the abusive parents, and your partner doesn't. What does this mean? It means that she doesn't agree, and she doesn't agree in any number of things. She doesn't agree with you that her parents were abusive. Maybe she doesn't agree with you that her parents didn't listen and make restitution. Maybe she doesn't agree with you that getting out of abusive relationships is a higher value. So she doesn't agree with you. Well, I don't know who's right or who's wrong, right? Because this is just a text message here, but what it means is that she doesn't agree with you. And this is stuff you should have worked out early on in the relationship, right? Early on in the relationship, you got to say, what do we do with abusive people? Are we going to have abusive people in our lives? Unrepentant, continuing to be abusive? Are we going to have those people in our life? Now, if she says no, right, then you say, no, this is the basis of our relationship, is we don't have abusive people in our life. So, you sign a contract with the bank that says they're going to charge you 4% interest on your mortgage for the next 10 years. You know, let's do a tiny rant here. It's the private company argument, right? Well, social media companies, they're private companies. They can do whatever they want. No, they can't do whatever the hell they want. No private company can do whatever the hell it wants. They can't sign contracts and willfully break them without consequences. Visa can't sit there and say, you know what? Screw the paperwork. We're going to charge you 5,000% this month. They can't do that. They can't do that. You can't order something, say, I'm going to pay you $1 million if you send me this thing. They send you this thing and it's like, screw it, I'm not paying you. I can do whatever. I'm a private company. I'm immune from morality. I'm immune from legality. I'm immune from consequences. Twitter said they were not deplatforming. They were not shadow banning. They were not doing any of that, particularly not based on ideology. They said that out in the open. That's a contract. That's a promise. They said it under oath. They said it under oath. We do not deplatform. We do not deplatform conservatives. We do not deboost. We do not, whatever language they're using, we do not shadow ban, right? We don't manipulate our platform based on ideology. Meanwhile, what, 98% of Twitter employees gave to Democrats? So under oath, they swore under penalty of perjury, they don't shadow ban at all, and they don't shadow ban based on ideology. When you say that, that's an explicit contract, and that draws people into the platform. Now, if it turns out you are fucking lying, then no, that's not something you can do. You can't swear under oath. We never do that, and certainly not based on ideology. And if it turns out, as it seems to be the case, that they did do that, and it was based on ideology, no, they can't do that. That's a kind of fraud, particularly the under oath thing. So no, this idea that private companies can do whatever they want. I mean, God, I mean, leftists and their private companies, can a guy bake a cake? Can a guy say, I don't want to bake a cake? Nope. Oh, we got rent control? Oh, people with apartments can't raise rent? Oh, well, private companies can do whatever they want? Are you kidding me? Private companies can't even build a house in California without 12 million licenses. I worked in the environmental field. You know the amount of environmental inspections and regulations and reports, and it was insane. The idea private companies can do whatever they want. Oh, really? Can they just pour sewage into the? No, it's just how it's so. Oh, and this is why politics became so boring. It just became so boring. Oh, yeah, private companies. The honoring the free will of private companies is absolutely essential when they're doing things that benefit us. The moment they do things that we oppose, well, private companies have to be tightly regulated. And we're talking about a very clear under perjury contract. No, they can't do whatever the hell they want. I mean, that's madness. They explicitly spoke of their terms of service under oath. Now the files are coming out. It seems pretty clear that they lied under oath. And if that, again, I'm no lawyer. If that's not fraud, I have no idea what fraud is. I have no idea what fraud is. If explicitly stating and having people invest billions of hours on a platform because they say we don't shadow ban based on ideology, but we don't shadow ban and we don't. There were two questions. Okay, Jack Dorsey, right? Do you shadow ban, basically? No. Do you shadow ban conservatives? No. And, you know, other people saying we don't shadow ban based on ideology, we don't deboost based on ideology, and then you got they've got this whole interface for deboosting and whatever, right? So people made deep, consequential business and life decisions based upon a specific and explicit contract under oath from social media companies. If it turns out they were lying, well, when they say private companies can do whatever they want, what they're really saying is when we're in control of private companies, we want to be able to screw whoever we want without consequences. Yeah, back to without consequences. All right, freedomain.com/donate. Thank you so much for dropping by today for a great deep and pleasurable chat about the world and its inhabitants. Freedomain.com/donate. Don't forget to check out freedomain.locals.com. My new book is going to be doing there. And over the next week or two, I'm going to show you how I edit chapters in case you're interested in this kind of writing advice and sort of my process of working through this stuff. So I hope that you will check that out. Love you guys so much. Have a great, super fantastic, wonderful day. And Catan Universe, please fix your servers. Take care, guys. Bye.